calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday, the first hour of our Friday program. Time for our brunch with Bernie, Congressman Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives, neither a Democrat nor a Republican, but in my opinion, I think of him as America's congressman. He's certainly a fine representative of the people of Vermont. Congressman Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Very good to be with you, Tom.
There was a disaster this morning. I believe it was this morning, or was it last night?
No, yesterday afternoon, actually.
In Essex, Vermont?
Yeah. You know, our small state does not usually wake up to find that two school teachers were killed on the same day by the same guy, and that's something that's rattling, I think, the people of Vermont. And what is particularly upsetting is not only two fine people were killed, these were teachers, and the impact that will have on hundreds and hundreds of kids and Essex and St. Albans is something that is very, very sad. So our condolences go out to the families and co-teachers and parents and teachers and students.
And for the people listening around the country who don't know, this was not a kid going into a school.
This was apparently, from what we can see now, a jilted lover or domestic type.
Right. The boyfriend of a teacher who went off after his...
It's a real, real tragedy. Something that our state, thank God, is not accustomed to, but people are upset.
Yeah.
But anyhow...
Yes, Labor Day is coming up.
Labor Day is coming up. And, Labor Day is the day of the year that we are supposed to be reflecting on what's happening to working people, their aspirations, where they are, where we want to go. And I think it's good to spend a minute just analyzing what is happening. And Tom, I want to congratulate you. I know that you have just come out with a new book which deals precisely with what is happening to the middle class and working families.
Yeah, the title is Screwed, The Undeclared War on the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It.
Well, I think that one-word title probably summarizes it all.
Yeah.
Because that is exactly what's going on. Senator Byron Dorgan, I know, has come out with another very good book on trade. And I think what we need to do right now, not just on Labor Day, but every other day of this week, is deal with this enormous issue, which, by the way, when we talk about corporate media, when we talk about media focusing on every bloody scandal or every act of sensationalism or every day in the life of Britney Spears, somehow, corporate media has forgotten to discuss the collapse of the middle class in America, the increase in poverty, the growing gap between the rich and the poor, and the fact that if we do not change Bush's trickle-down economic theories, for the first time in the modern history of America, our kids are going to have a lower standard of living than their parents. Now, I know not quite as important as Britney Spears' new child. I know that. Hey, I don't want to prejudge this thing, but it might be something that the media might want to take a look at, because this is something that is impacting the lives of tens and tens of millions of Americans. You know, and when you look at the collapse of the middle class, this is not like some kind of, you know, tsunami or some kind of storm or hurricane that is causing devastation. This is as a result of policies developed by the United States Congress, various presidents, and mostly corporate America, who have in fact gone to war against the middle class of this country. And we need to analyze it. We need to discuss it. And the irony of all of this is that while the average American today has seen a decline in his or her standard of living, working longer hours for lower wages, it was just a piece of the paper, you may have seen this, Tom, where the idea of the two-week vacation, did you see that piece?
No, I didn't.
Two-week vacation is now something of the past.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Well, now, we don't have the time anymore to take two-week vacations, let alone a month vacation. Our people probably work longer hours than any other people in the industrialized world.
Yeah, we surpassed Japan, I think, a year or two ago.
Yeah, our people are stressed out. They're just, you know, very few middle-class families that I know where you don't have husband and wife both working. And the question that we have got to ask ourselves is, why is this happening? People are now, working people are now far more productive than used to be the case as a result of exploding technology. So why is it that 30 years ago the expectation of being in the middle class was one person working 40 hours a week? Today you have two people working incredible hours, and you know what? Study from Harvard indicates that there's less disposable income now from a two-income family than there was 30 years ago from a one-income family. Why? What's going on? And the answer, obviously, is a lot of facts that are going out there. But certainly one of them is that in the last 9 years, our good friends in Washington, the president, the Republican leadership, have just not gotten around to raising a national $5.15 minimum wage. They do have plenty of time to devote to hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks for the richest 1%. They have a lot of time devoted to trying to destroy Social Security, to cut back on Medicare, but raise the national minimum wage above $5.15 an hour, my goodness, we just can't quite do that. And the second issue, and I know you and I have talked about this a whole lot, Byron Dorgan has written a book on this, senator from North Dakota, and that is our disastrous trade policies. And the fact that the so-called free trade, end of quote, is nothing more than an opportunity for large multinational corporations to say to American workers, guess what? Your competition is in China. Those people are making 50 cents an hour. They're going to go to jail if they stand up for their political rights. When we go to China, we can destroy the environment there with impunity. And what are you going to do about it? You prepared to compete with China and work for 50 cents an hour? Well, maybe we'll stay here. And this is a huge issue that we as Americans have got to deal with. We need fundamental changes in our trade policies. We've got to tell the General Electrics, the IBMs, all of these big corporations, and it's just virtually every single one of them. You know, the guy who is the head of General Electric a few years ago gave a speech to some investors there, and he said, you know, when I look at the future of General Electric, I see China, 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 and China. Yeah. And then, by the way, the only time they do see the United States, they do pay attention to us now and then. You know what it is? To come to Washington and say, hey, we need some corporate welfare.
Right.
Hey, taxpayers. By the way, we're really busy right now. We're throwing American workers out on the street and moving to China, but we have a few minutes to ask for billions of dollars from taxpayers to help us do whatever it is we want to do. I mean, and that is the outrage that is going on in Washington. It's been going on for years. It has been it certainly intensified under this Bush administration, which works night and day for the wealthiest people in this country. But if we do not change these policies, and that is not just the loss of blue-collar jobs, and as you know, we've lost almost 3 million good-paying manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years of my small state of Vermont, which has never been a great manufacturing leader in America. We've lost 20% of our manufacturing jobs in 5 years. We're on the cusp now, all over this country, of losing millions and millions. This economist, Alan Blinder, wrote a study where it says tens of millions of jobs are now at risk, because if you are doing your job right now, fellow American, working on a computer, the likelihood is that job can be done in India, it could be done in China, it could be done in Russia, for people who are very smart, very hardworking, and are prepared to work for a fraction of the wages that we make. And if we just sit back and say, oh, this is free trade, this is just terrific, and government shouldn't play a role here, you know, we don't want to get in the way of corporate America, you're going to end up in a nation that looks like some, you know, Latin American third world existence, where a handful of people have virtually all of the wealth, all of the income, and everybody else is just scrambling to keep their heads above water. And we've got to turn that around. And that's the great challenge, I think, facing working families in America, is to stand up and say to Washington, sorry, our government is supposed to represent all of the people, and not just large multinational corporations, and not just the very, very wealthy. Very few people, in addition to all of that, John Edwards being one, are talking about what is just almost invisible in America, that in the last 5 years under Bush, 5 million more Americans have slipped into poverty. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world. We have, people sleeping out on the streets. This is not what America is supposed to be about. So those are some of the issues that we have really got to be working on.
Yeah. Paul Krugman recently pointed out that this is all about politics, too. He said, from 1929 to 1947, the real wages of production workers in manufacturing in the United States rose 67%, while the richest 1% went up, actually fell 17%. Post-war boom, real wages, this is 47 to 73, real wages went up 81% for average production workers. The top 1% only went up 38%. But now, after Reagan, the new Gilded Age, the real wages of manufacturing workers fell 1%. While the richest 1%, their wages went up 135%.
That is the America of 2006, and that is what we have got to change if the middle class in America is to survive.
Amen. 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be taking your calls for Bernie Sanders right after this.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome to George Bush National Park, where the air smells just like diesel. And there ain't no animals left around here except snakes, skunks, rats, and weasels. Now we ain't got no waterfalls or rivers. This environment of stuff gives us the shivers. And we don't need Yellowstone or Carlsbad Caverns. Cause all the wildlife we need is in the tavern.
And welcome back, yeah. Welcome to George W. Bush National Park. Where the air smells just like diesel. 22 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Talk radio for the rest of us. Our brunch with Bernie, our Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our number 866-440-THOM, 440-8466. And Armin in Florida, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Bernie?
Yes.
There is a crisis in Florida right now that they're keeping it out of the media, but it's really hitting home to a lot of working class, poor working people, and middle class. And our property taxes, I consider us middle class, our property taxes are going to go up 50% this year, plus insurance is going up on a lot of these people two and three times.
Wow.
And what the deal is here is these Republicans say they believe in a free market, but they really don't, because the billionaires and millionaires that live on the beachfront, their taxes are not going tripling and are going up and at the same rate as the working class, and their property insurance is not going up tripling like a lot of these poor working people that can't afford it. And the thing is, if they truly believed in a free market like they perpetrate on us all the time, what they would be doing is their insurance would be going so high on the beachfront that their property would be deflating, like the people's property is deflating that's paying for everything, the poor people.
Well, I obviously don't know all the details of the property tax situation in Florida, but what I do know is that in my state of Vermont and all over this country, higher and higher property taxes, and the property tax is itself an extremely regressive tax because it's really not based on ability to pay. I know that these high property taxes are killing a lot of people, killing a lot of seniors, causing a real problem in terms of getting school budgets passed. And to my mind, it really speaks to the need for an overhaul in our entire tax system. So that we create a system which is based on ability to pay rather than on regressive taxes like the property taxes or various types of sales taxes. And obviously, under Bush, we are moving in exactly the wrong direction from a federal perspective. Now, I'm sure in Florida, as well as in Vermont, for example, we are hit very, very hard by the high cost of special education. And as many listeners will remember, the federal government said, well, we're going to cover a very significant part of the cost of special education, the mainstreaming of kids with disabilities, but they haven't done it. So what Bush wants to do is give hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the wealthiest 1%, but helping school districts in Florida, Vermont, or any other part of the country, why we can't afford to do that. So you raise a very important question, Armin, believe me, which does not just impact Florida. It impacts Vermont. It impacts every other state in America, how we break our dependency on regressive taxes like the property tax, how we ask the very wealthy, whose income is exploding, to start paying their fair share so that all of our kids can get a decent education.
Ravi in Chile, New Mexico. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was rather shocked. I was reading Aviation Week and Space Technology, the July 31st issue. And it states in there that the Association of the U.S. Army says that Fort Sam Houston, Texas, has not paid its utility bill since March. And dining halls have been closed at Fort Knox, Kentucky, and Fort Carson, Colorado. It looks like the Army is getting screwed like this middle class. And how did this happen?
Well, you got me. It's not for lack of a large defense budget, that's for sure. The defense budget is now over $400 billion. Maybe, and I don't know the specifics of what you're talking about, but certainly there was a study. I don't know if you saw this, Tom, just the other day, Henry Waxman on the Government Reform Committee, on which I sit, pointed out the huge amounts of contracts that were given, no-bid contracts that were given for the Hurricane Katrina rebuilding.
I've got a story on that, Bernie. There's a Texas company that got a no-bid contract to haul out debris from New Orleans for $23 a cubic yard. They gave it to another Texas company for $18 a cubic yard. They gave it to another company, we don't know where they're based, for $16 a cubic yard. They gave it to a New Jersey company for $9 a cubic yard. They gave it to a guy who did it for $3 a cubic yard. And all the companies upstream were all Bush cronies.
Yep.
I mean, you know, this is incredible.
It is incredible. And then, you know, gentleman, you know, is talking about the defense budget, and we know similar type of bidding processes have gone on in Iraq with our friends at Halliburton making out like bandits through no bid contracts.
You can't govern if you don't believe in government. And these guys just see government as a place where they can steal some cash. It's a shame. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Our number 866-440-8466. You can drop into our live chat room at TomHartman.com. 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Give a little bit of your love to me. Give a little bit of my love to you.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars with Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, there's an audio sneak peek of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War on the Middle Class and What You Can Do About It, over at the website for the radio station where I do a morning program, 620kpoj.com. And I actually read a chapter, and there's some clips in there of Roosevelt and Eisenhower. So you just go to 620kpoj.com and click on sneak peek or keyword search Screwed. You'll get it. So, anyhow, welcome back. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. And Bernie, let's see here, Jim in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line with you. Jim, you're live with Bernie.
Hi, Tom and Bernie. Bernie, I agree with everything you're saying, and I'm just wondering if you have any allies in Congress or if you're the only voice there.
No, there aren't. I mean, and thanks, Jim, for asking that question. I think when Tom and I talk about the failure of the corporate media to really cover the issues important to people, I think one of the issues that we're talking about is they don't cover Congress very, very well. And what you see on television, you know, day after day are the same guys. It's John McCain or Senator Lieberman or whoever it may be. And there are a lot of good people in the Senate and in the House who are, in fact, standing up and fighting for working people. Believe me, it is not just me. I mean, I mentioned Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota a few minutes ago, who just has been a leader in opposition to these disastrous trade agreements. He has allies in the Senate. I certainly look forward to being one of those allies when I get there. But also in the House, you know, you've got Peter DeFazio of Oregon, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, many good people there.
Jim McDermott up in Washington.
Jim McDermott does a great job up in the state of Washington, and dozens and dozens more. Now, generally speaking, Those of us who are progressive, who are standing up for working families, who are trying to take on big money interests, you know, we don't end up on the Sunday news shows too often. Those are usually kind of, you know, right-center type people who fit into the mainstreams, into the corporate media's definition of what a good politician should be. But to answer Jim's question, while we are in the minority, to be sure, I don't want to overstate the situation, by and large, the Congress is in fact controlled by big money interests and people who represent big money interests, but there are dozens and dozens of strong fighters in the House and in the Senate who
Bernie,
are trying to stand up for workers.
Bernie, you were the founder of the Progressive Caucus of the House of Representatives. How many members are in that caucus?
There are now, I believe, over 60. And that caucus is now being chaired by Barbara Lee of California and Lynn Woolsey of California. And what we have done with that caucus is bring people from all over the country, East Coast, West Coast, South, North, the Black Caucus is involved in it, and the Hispanic Caucus, Women's Caucus. It's a very diversified group of people who are standing up, among other things, not only leading the opposition against the war in Iraq, but are also saying, look, the middle class is, to quote the title of your book, Tom, being screwed. And we need policies which reflect the interest of ordinary people, not just millionaires. So I don't want the listeners to think that, you know, there aren't any people in Congress trying to wage the good fight. There are people who are working really, really hard, doing a lot of good work. We are in a distinct minority, no question about it, but there are people there. Clearly, we need a lot more help.
Yeah, well said. Dennis in Louisville, Kentucky, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello, gentlemen. I haven't talked to you in a while. I just got a question. I think, there's a lot of apathy as far as the American public goes, and I think we got to start using something to fire them up, get them really excited about this. And I don't understand, since these guys are endangering with their free trade policies and their free trade fallacies, that they're endangering the country as far as our long-term security, why these guys aren't compared to Rosenberg or Benedict Arnold. Just call it treason. I think they need to use that word more on the floor. And just say, it's out and out treason.
Well, I think you make a strong point, and that is what we are seeing is the selling out of America. And when you hear and understand that these heads of large corporations really don't any longer have an allegiance to the United States of America, these large multinationals, in many instances, no longer consider themselves American corporations. And frankly, I will not be shocked if in the next 10 years you're going to see a number of these companies establishing their main offices in China. That would not surprise me. They see their allegiance to primarily themselves and their ability to make huge amounts of income every year, and CEOs of large corporations now make 400 times more than the average worker in those corporations. They see their allegiance to their stockholders, but they certainly do not see their allegiance to the people of America or their employees. For them, the bottom line is what it's all about, and if it means selling out America, not a problem, not a problem
right.
at all.
You have Halliburton's Kellogg Brown and Root division that reincorporated in the Cayman Islands, so they
yeah,
wouldn't
sure,
have
they
to
can
pay
avoid
taxes.
Paying a few million dollars in taxes. What's
yeah,
the problem? What's
yeah,
the problem?
And they're the ones who are getting all the contracts for Iraq, and they're talking even about spinning that off as a separate entity now.
And as you know, Tom, many of us in many different ways have tried to deal with this issue unsuccessfully with the Republican leadership and the President of the United States. And we said, hey, if I was involved, I'm on the Financial Services Committee, and there's a program in Washington called the Export-Import Bank, which provides loans and subsidies to corporations involved in exporting. And what we said is, gee, why do we continue to give taxpayers' money to large multinational corporations who tell us, they're very honest about it, they're moving out of America?
Yeah.
Why don't we help the small and medium-sized businesses who want to grow decent-paying jobs right here in the United States of America?
Well,
not a very radical proposal.
Because those businesses don't have the Republican Party in their back pocket.
That's right. I mean, it gets back, well, yeah. I think
I knew your question was rhetorical, but I just couldn't resist the answer. Hey, Gary, driving in Ohio. Hey, Gary, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. I've got a good question for you. I'm a truck driver, and it seems that Congress and people don't really care about the wage that we make. My wife and I work and drive 70 hours a week apiece with no overtime. Our wages are regulated by our corporate companies that turn down our speedometers, and when you're paid by the mile, that's taking money out of your back pocket our wages are regulated by states that have slower speed limits, such as 55 miles an hour, which lower our speed limits. And plus, we get put on daily runs or routes where we have to do a lot of drops, so we have to do a lot of work, and then we're paid less than the minimum wage. Congress has also gone through and played with our logbook to make it impossible to get down the road and make any type of money. Is there any type of thought process going on in Congress that will allow a driver to make a decent wage these days and not have to work 70 hours a week with his wife to make ends meet? I'm not going to stay for the response. I'm going to listen on the radio because I am driving. So thank you very much for your time.
Well, Gary, thanks very much for raising that issue. I mean, and this is just one of 100 issues in which working people, you know, are just getting killed. And here you have a guy working 70 hours a week in the United States of America in the year 2006. And what, his wife is also working long hours. Is this the America that we should be at this particular point in our history? And the answer is obvious. So Gary asked what's being done for truck drivers. And the answer is that so long as you have a Republican leadership in Washington that works frantically for deregulating everything they possibly can, privatizing everything that they possibly can, giving more and more power to corporate executives to send jobs abroad or to lower the standard of living of American workers like Gary, now nothing is going to happen. And that's why this election is so extraordinarily important. America, as Gary just told us, and Gary is speaking for millions and millions and millions of workers in my state of Vermont and all over this country, people should not have to work 70 hours a week in the United States of America to earn a living. And that is what is going on. And that's what this election is about, is changing the direction of this country so that we begin to have legislation and policies which reflect work, the needs of working people, and not just the bosses, and not just the CEOs of large corporations, and not just the wealthy and the powerful.
Mark in Jacksonville, Florida. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Hey, Bernie. Hopefully you can hear me. Getting back to the outsourcing issue that you mentioned earlier on the program, another facet, I think, to all this is the fact that the federal government also cuts Pell Grants. So here you've got a situation where the people that need the Pell Grants, parents, don't have a job, and suddenly we're going to become this banana republic. It's so obvious.
Mark, you hit it right on that. You know, for years, don't get me going on this. Like, no.
I think you just did.
All right, don't get me really going on this issue. We just had a press conference here in Burlington. Our friends in the White House, you know, who believe in tax breaks for billionaires, earlier this year, they cut $12 billion from student loan programs. And that means that students, college students in America and their parents are going to be paying higher interest rates. It means that literally hundreds of thousands of qualified high school graduates are not going to college because they're looking out in front of them and they're saying, gee, the economy is volatile. Do I want to come out of college $50,000 in debt? Is that really what I want? I'm not going to go to college. So think about what it means. What this stupidity means in terms of our policies in Washington, in forcing young people who have the ability not to go to college, it is not only an attack on their lives, because they're not going to be able to get a college education, not make it in most instances to the middle class. It is an attack on America. Everybody knows we need well-educated workers, and we're not getting them. Because Bush prefers tax breaks for billionaires rather than financial aid for college students.
Well, and then he'll just start importing folks from India. I mean, it's
just, well, that's another issue.
Yeah, there you go. 45 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders of Vermont. We'll be back right after this break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's my life, and I do what I want. It's my mind, and I think what I want. Show me the law, hurt me sometimes, but someday I'll teach you to refine.
And Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman radio program, and the way you can support our program. Support our sponsors, Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. SacredGroundsCoffee.com, their website, their telephone number, 1-800-425-2532. 1-800-425-2532. And Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPods now and all things Macintosh at Small Dog. www.smalldog.com, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS. Doc in Austin, Texas, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hey. Good morning.
Bernie, I consider you a man's man for the job that you do and standing up for the working man, and you also, Tom.
Thank you.
I'm an independent trucker and have been for almost 30 years now, and that 70 hours a week is a joke. Bernie, I need you to explain to me about this war on the middle class. It's something I don't understand. You know, I used to be able to buy, within reason, anything I wanted to on my salary. And, I mean, I'd buy new cars, a new pickup truck, new furniture, TV, a house. I mean, you know, like the regular Americans would do. And in the last 15 years or so, it has just steadily eroded and gone downhill to where I work twice as hard as I used to, twice as long. I haul more stuff than I used to, and I don't buy crap. I don't hardly buy anything anymore. So my question to you is, what is in it for multinational corporations to have a war in the middle class if I can't afford to buy their stuff?
Well, for a start, they really don't stay up nights worrying about you. They are moving in many ways to China, where they are producing products with workers who make 50 cents an hour. And if your standard of living goes down, it is not their problem, because what I can tell you is their standard of living is going up. What is happening in this country is not just that the middle class is declining and poverty is increasing. The people on top are doing phenomenally well. The growth of income of the wealthiest people, and I think, Tom, you just mentioned some figures a few moments ago.
138% for the top 1% since Reagan came into office. And before that, it had averaged around 30% for the last 60 years.
And in the future, if they can sell their products in China and make money off of a growing middle class in China, that money is quite as good as money being spent here in the United States of America. And some people say, well, don't they care? Don't they understand what they're doing to the middle class? And the answer is, yeah, they do. It just doesn't matter. They don't care. And number two, these guys don't think long-term. They're not, you think they're worried about what America's going to look like 10 years from now? They're not. They're worried about what their bottom line is going to be next quarter. Now, if this country goes down the tubes and the middle class is dissolved, it ain't their problem. But it is the problem and should be the problem of the United States Congress and the President of the United States. And I think it's time is long overdue that we begin standing up to these corporate people who think they can do anything they want to the workers of this country.
I'd add a third dimension to this, Bernie, that I talk about in my book, Screwed, and that is that when you read the writings of the ideologues, the people who, Leo Strauss, the neocons that started writing back in the 50s and 60s, the golden age of the American middle class, they saw people protesting. They saw African Americans saying that they wanted equal rights. They saw women saying that they wanted equal rights. And they looked at this and they said, these people have too much time and money. When you have a strong and vibrant middle class, you have a strong and vibrant democracy, and that threatens the power structure in an oligarchy.
You know, Tom, that is a very good point. And with that, let me just emphasize and elaborate on that, because what you see in Washington right now is not truck drivers and working people coming down, being able to make demands on Congress. What you have are lobbyists who are paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year by the wealthiest people in this country. We go, you know, I hold probably more town meetings in the state of Vermont than, you know, maybe every other public official combined, because it's important to go out to small communities, large communities, hear what people have to say. And very often people tell me, and I'd love to come to your meeting, I can't come because we're tired, we're exhausted, we're working long hours, we've got to stay home with the kids, we can't get, you know, a babysitter. So your point is well taken, that literally we have a workforce now which is stretched to its limits. People don't have time to take vacations, and they certainly do not, and this is your point, have the time or as much time as they need to be involved in the political process. They're working all of the time just trying to stay alive and pay the bills.
Dave in Eureka, California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Tom. And Bernie, I have long regarded you as a real gentleman, and I think for the longest time you have wanted to try to give the benefit of the doubt to the opposition. I'm not hearing that today. I think you more and more have come to the conclusion I have. We have some really evil folks that have gained office, I believe, by rigging elections. They are there to inflict a great deal of harm on us to benefit themselves, and I think you're seeing that more and more clearly, or I think we're in agreement on it. You'd like to say, I think you're well-meaning people who are just making dumb decisions, but it's no longer that, is it?
No, what I think there are is there are many decent Republicans around this country, you know, people who are conservative, who want to limit the role of government and so forth and so on. But what I want to say to you, Dave, I see it in Vermont and I see it all over America. A lot of these decent Republicans are looking to Washington and they're seeing George Bush and Tom DeLay and they're saying, hey, this is not a conservative party. This is not a party that I feel comfortable being a part of. This is, in fact, a party that is going to war against Main Street, representing Wall Street, and a party which has values that I no longer feel comfortable. So you're seeing a lot of traditional Republicans saying, enough is enough. This is no longer my party.
Yeah, Dwight Eisenhower rolling over in his grave right
now. Yep, I think so.
I'll tell you. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the longest serving independent in the House, in the history of the House of Representatives, a fine public servant and a great man. Congressman Sanders, thank you so much for being with
Good
us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Well, we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Coming up later on in the program, John Zogby is going to be with us, president and CEO of Zogby International. The latest polls, we'll get all the information on that. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Divide and conquer. That is the absolute strategy of the Republicans and the Bush administration. It has been, well, you go back to Nixon. He started with the Southern strategy in 1972, saying, well, you know, the Democrats pretty much had the corner on racism after the Civil War. The Democrats had largely the party of the South after the Civil War, and, well, even leading up to the Civil War, arguably. And the Republicans, the party of the Union of the North, and the Democrats, right up through you could argue, I think, frankly, quite effectively, at least up until Roosevelt's administration, and frankly, beyond that, on a local and a statewide level, were the party of racism in the United States. And the Democratic Party decided to change that. I mean, you know, that was a very significant, very conscious decision that was made, in large part during Jack Kennedy's administration. And his brother Bobby went on to just be a champion for civil rights in the United States. And Lyndon Johnson then carried on with that after Jack Kennedy was assassinated. And so Nixon said, hey, there's a bunch of racists out there. We can pick these guys up. They're voters. And so Nixon came up with his so-called Southern strategy and said, yeah, let's go for the race vote. And Bill Moyers on this program, the conversation we had with him a few months ago when I was broadcasting live from the Take Back America conference in Washington, D.C., and he sat down with us for a conversation. And my recollection is he said that he was in the room with Lyndon Johnson when this happened. They brought him the Civil Rights Act, Civil Rights Act of 1967, sat down and said, one of his advisors said to him, Mr. President, if you sign this piece of legislation, the Democratic Party will lose the South for a generation. Now, keep in mind, this was after Nixon had declared that the Republicans were going after the racists in the South. And not just the South. I mean, he called it the Southern Strategy. But basically, Nixon, as we know now from the tapes, intentionally decided that the Republican Party would start aggressively reaching out to racists. And this is, you know, Strom Thurmond changed parties, went from being a Democrat to being a Republican. And you know, a number of politicians, in fact, did as a consequence of that. And Lyndon Johnson said, you know, if we lose the South for a generation, that's a price I'm willing to pay to have equality and an egalitarian society in the United States. I mean, those are not his exact words, but words to that. He said, if that's the price, it's a price I'm willing to pay. Those were his exact words, according to Bill Moyers. Well, it's continuing. And it's not just race. I mean, it's divide and conquer by income, divide and conquer by race, divide and conquer by region, divide and conquer by gender. I mean, let's just look at some of this stuff that the Bush administration's up to. Here's a story from the Los Angeles Times Washington Post service by David Savage in today's newspaper. The Bush administration has urged the Supreme Court to strike down voluntary school integration programs. Voluntary school integration programs. Administration lawyers filed briefs this week in pending cases from Seattle and Louisville, Kentucky, on the side of white parents who are challenging racial balancing programs as unconstitutional. They're saying that African-American parents being able to choose to send their kids to white schools amounts to racial discrimination and violates the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection of the laws. The lower courts, by the way, ruled in favor of the parents in the voluntary school integration programs. They note the Seattle School Board adopted integration guidelines for its 10 high schools beginning with the 1998-99 year. Officials said they hope to preserve racial diversity in the schools and prevent segregation in the schools that mirrored the racially segregated housing patterns in the city. In the case of parents involved in community schools versus Seattle, a group of parents sued to challenge the guidelines after their children were denied enrollment in their first choice high school because of race or ethnicity. In other words, the white schools, what had previously been the white-only schools, they had fewer places for white kids because African-American kids were coming into the school. And so now the white kids who are not able to go to those schools are saying, hey, wait a minute, that's a tough one. That's a tough one in terms of, hey, I'd like to go to the school down the street. And yet at the same time, are we sanctioning racial division in this country? I would suggest to you that things in many ways are getting so much worse. And all the rhetoric about illegal immigration in particular is feeding the racism, the hysteria, the frenzy around racism in this country. You got Pat Buchanan out there, you know, pounding the pavement. And, yeah, I think he's right about that we have to have integrity. The integrity of our borders has to be real. And I'm not talking about a wall or a fence. I think that's a crazy idea. But I am talking about prosecuting employers who hire illegal aliens in order to drive down the cost of labor. That just is a no-brainer to me. But it doesn't have to be framed in a way that has a racial frame around it. And there are so many people out there now who are doing that. So there's that. And then now here, let's divide and conquer by virtue of wealth. Healthcare debts. This is from MSNBC, Newsweek. Karen Springen writing in Newsweek, Health Hazards. The subtitle, How Mounting Medical Costs Are Plunging More Families Into Debilitating Debt and Why Insurance Doesn't Always Keep Them Out of Bankruptcy. She writes, healthcare debts typically play a role in about half of the approximately 1.5 million bankruptcies filed in the U.S. each year. 75% of those who declare medical bankruptcy have health insurance at the onset of the illness that failed to prevent them from being pushed over the financial edge. Why? Well, she says many families are shouldering more of the health care costs than ever before. As Henry Summer, president of the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys, said, the copays and deductibles are becoming so big that even if you have insurance, you still have a lot of medical debt. How much debt? One-fifth of working-age adults, both insured and uninsured. That's one out of every five working-age Americans currently has medical debt that they're paying off over time. And three out of five adults with medical bills or debt problems say they were insured at the time the debt was incurred. So not only are the health insurance companies getting more and more profitable, the second largest health insurance company in the United States last year paid their CEO $1.5 billion in compensation. I mean, these companies are incredibly rich. But they're also screwing the middle class. I mean, there's no other way to say it. And as I pointed out in the last hour, you go back and you read the writings of some of the neoconservatives from the 60s and 70s, and they were looking at social unrest, what they perceived as social unrest, students speaking out against the war in Vietnam, women wanting equal rights in the workplace, African-Americans demanding equal an end to discrimination and equal access to schools and to institutions. And they said, oh, this is a society in meltdown. This is the end of the American culture. We can't have this. If this is what happens when you have a middle class, when you have students who know that they can get into college for free pretty much anywhere or very, very cheap, then we can't allow that. We've got to terrify them. We've got to make them work so hard that they don't have time to be out protesting. I mean, they literally looked at it like that and said, you know, having a middle class, these people have too much free time. They have too much money. 2 weeks of vacation a year? Oh, you can't have that. They might show up at a protest. In Newsweek, she points out Americans are taking out home equity lines of credit to pay for medical expenses. The solution? Universal health care, of course. Medicare for all. Just make the Medicare program fine for everybody. In the meantime, the Republicans who brought us the Republican Great Depression are now, according to MarketWatch, MarketWatch.com, Rex Nutting writing for MarketWatch, going to be bringing us the Republican Great Recession. Hear this from MarketWatch.com. You can read it over there. The United States is headed for a recession that will be much nastier and deeper and more protracted than the 2001 recession, says Noriel Robini, president of Robini Global Economics. Writing on his blog Wednesday, Robini repeated his call that the U.S. would be in recession in 2007, arguing that the collapse of housing would bring down the rest of the economy. He said, this is the biggest housing slump in the last 40 or 50 years. Every housing indicator is in free fall, including now housing prices. The impact of the bursting of the bubble, they write over at MarketWatch.com, will affect every household in America, not just the few people who own significant shares in technology companies during the dot-com boom. Prices are falling even in the Midwest, which never experienced a bubble. A scary signal, he says, of how much pain the drop in household wealth would cause. Why? Because people have been borrowing from their homes to maintain their lifestyle during the first 5 years of the George W. Bush Great Recession. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Don't think of buying from Canada. Oh, we will not play nice. We wrote for new legislation forcing the nation to pay the top price. Oh, Grandma, sign the paper. Grandpa, don't be slow. Yes, you get medication. If you join our HMO, there's no more Medicare. Oh, you'll just have to trust us while we're making Medicare go bust.
Watch indeed.
Companies lining up.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. George W. Bush spent 90 minutes with families of slain soldiers this morning, and he's in Maine for a vacation with his family. And afterwards, one of the families, an anti-war widow, who lost her husband, Army National Guard Captain Patrick Damon, his wife, Hildy Halley, she said to George Bush, she said, it's time to stop the bleeding. It's time to swallow our pride and find a solution. She said that Bush replied, there's no point in us having a philosophical discussion about the pros and cons of war. Yeah. She says, normally I realize this is a huge honor to speak to the president, but under the circumstances, I need to think about it. Anyhow, it's an interesting story. 1-866-440-8255. 8466, our telephone number. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I hear it in your voice. It is so doggone serious. It's exactly that. You know, it is the
people are dying, Gary. People are dying. The people are dying, and they're dying so that this guy could lie us into a war so that he could get himself reelected and he could put Republicans in control of the Senate in the year 2002.
Let's talk just a little
bit about it, if I may.
And that's
a sin.
You know, it is the middle class that's being destroyed, flat out. But let me ask you this. Doesn't the middle class, in a lot of ways, good people, smarter people than me, but aren't they a little stupid at times in the voting booth?
I am not willing to blame the voters, Gary. I really am not. People, you know, it's like saying, aren't people stupid for buying some of the products they do? Yeah, you know, assuming that everybody had access to equal information. The problem is that our system has been hijacked. It's been hijacked by corrupt politicians and by corporations hell-bent for leather on creating essentially an oligarchy in the United States. And we need to wake people up, and we need to take it back. And I really think that blaming the voters is not the solution. It is not. And looking at folks who don't know what's going on and calling them yahoos or whatever, you know, that's not the solution either. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us from Louisiana. Hey, Ellen.
Doing? I am down here in the Gulf, and of course things have not changed dramatically, unfortunately. The president is due to arrive here on Monday in Gulfport. Of course, they're not going to be, they never tell you where he's going to be ahead of time, so that they can't have protesters where he's going to be. And then he's going to New Orleans, and they're not telling us where he's going to be in New Orleans. And as I pointed out to my family who's down here with me, it's amazing that he never visits high schools. He only visits elementary school.
Well, that's because high school students talk back.
Well, at which my niece said if she had an elementary school teacher, a student, she'd teach him to do everything and ask every question, him or her, of the president, even if she or he didn't understand what they were asking.
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen the joke. It's been circulating in email where Bush comes to an elementary school and he says, "I'll take questions." And little kid stands up, Stanley stands up and says, "Mr. President, why did you lie us into the war in Iraq?" And all of a sudden the bell rings and all you know, everybody has to leave the classroom. And when they come back in the classroom, another student raises his hand and. And Bush says, "Okay, what's your question, Johnny?" And Johnny stands up and he says, "Number one, I'm curious why you lied us into a war in Iraq. Number two, why did the bell ring 15 minutes early? And number three, where's Stanley?"
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I don't know if you also saw two interesting things. State Department is investigating whether Israel used cluster bombs in civilian populations in southern Lebanon. Kofi Annan says there will be. He's hoping for a 15,000 person troops in southern Lebanon.
Now the French have committed 2,000. Has anybody else committed troops so far?
I think Italy definitely has. And then, of course, you have every small country in the world that is looking for a handout from the United States, and there's a quid pro quo on that one.
Yeah, so they'll toss a few hundred troops in. But 15,000 is quite a few if you're pulling them together, 1,000 here, 1,000 there. Of course, I guess there's a lot of nations, 500 here, 500 there, they can probably pull
exactly. Them. I mean, that's what we certainly saw initially. Remember the Coalition of the Willing in Iraq?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, we just have maybe 20 seconds here. How are things going down in Louisiana?
Well, I have not yet. Louisiana's this weekend, so I'll have a report for you on the anniversary, but I'm in Mississippi right now. And, you know, it's just amazing that you see really the entire coast of Mississippi completely devastated and people inland. You know, if you only had 2 inches of water and you got black mold, that's the end of your house.
Ellen, is there more information about this at talkradionews.com and how people can help out?
Talkradionews.com and ThroughTheEyeOfTheStorm.com.
ThroughTheEyeOfTheStorm.com, the book that Sholene wrote.
That's right, and the updates on our community center, et cetera.
Great. Thank you so much. Ellen Ratner, talkradionews.com. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Into the distance, further on black. Stretch to the point of no turning back. Fly to fancy on a windswept field. Standing alone, my senses reel.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in the Democracy Zone, Tom Hartman radio program. By the way, just a heads up, on the 5th of September, I'll be doing a book signing at Powell's Books, and on the 9th at Vox Pop in Brooklyn, New York. On the 15th and 16th of September, I'll be in Berkeley in San Francisco at Modern Times Book Passage in Black Oaks Books. And then it continues on from there, Los Angeles on the 30th and Seattle. Coming up, let's see, that's going to be on the 6th of October. So on it goes. You can find it all over at tomhartman.com. Vox Pop in Brooklyn is the bookstore on the 9th that we'll be at. John Zogby is with us. He is the president and CEO of Zogby International, the website zogby.com. John Zogby, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you again.
Great to have you back with us, John. You've been doing a lot of polling. You guys do a lot of polling. I'm just amazed by the output that you're generating here. This fascinating new poll on Hurricane Katrina, and you've got some new numbers on George W. Bush. Which would you like to take first?
Well, let's do Katrina.
Okay.
You know, we're getting close to the anniversary, and essentially there's a lot of skepticism. Over 80% of the American people think that the recovery has gone slow, and that New Orleans will probably never fully recover and never get back to what it ever was. That's accurate, and I think probably very sad at the same time.
Where are Americans placing the blame for this?
Well, essentially, they're still placing the blame today where they were placing it a year ago, and that is government at all levels, in particular, though, the federal government. You know, Americans, maybe one at a time, can't parse these things, but, you know, when the group speaks as a whole, they place, in this instance, place blame on where they thought the chief responsibility was. I mean, who has the resources? The city doesn't. The private sector doesn't. You know, the state doesn't. It's the federal government that gets most of the blame, and in particular, the administration.
John Zogby, we're talking with John Zogby of Zogby International, Zogby.com, the website. I'm curious if the majority of Americans are placing the blame for the slow cleanup of New Orleans, which the vast majority of them seem to condemn, or at least acknowledge in negative terms, you know, slow or whatever. Are they differentiating between the federal government as an entity, as a static entity that has existed for 230 years, and the Bush administration as a temporary administration with a particular set of ideology and ways of doing things? Or are they simply, you know, to what extent do they separate those two?
To a great extent. Well, I mean, first of all, we're seriously polarized in this country, and so you get overwhelming blame on toward the Bush administration from Democrats and from independents, less so from among Republicans. But still a considerable number of Republicans that do. They're able to differentiate, although they do tell us in a number of questions that we ask that it's probably time for a whole new definition of the role of federal government when it comes to catastrophes and emergencies. They want the federal government to be a leader and not just simply an ATM machine. And I think what they found was initially, both roles were lacking when it came to Katrina. You know, I think what's very important to note here is that the American people may have soured on some aspects of the federal government, and we don't need to list that. But they do recognize that the federal government it's got to be the place to go to when you're talking about such large issues as this. You know, In the aftermath of Katrina, within a couple of months, it was reported that Americans raised $1 billion via private charities. Now, I mean, those are canisters in stores, $50, $100 checks, plus some large checks. But as your listeners understand, that's 2.5 minutes worth of legislation on Capitol Hill to raise $1 billion. Capitol Hill, with the leadership of the administration, can raise $100 billion for emergencies of this sort.
Certainly. And we've raised about five times that for this, for the war in Iraq, for example. I mean, you know, it's
exactly.
Just, we kind of rolled forward with it. One of the questions that I thought was most interesting in your recent survey that had to do with Katrina, you've got into some of the larger issues. And there's one question. In the last 75 years, we've had two major definitions of the role of federal government in our lives, this New Deal Great Society versus the what you refer to as the New Federalism. Can you explain how the question was asked and how the responses broke out on that?
Yep. As your listeners need to know, I'm on vacation, so I don't have every number in front of me, and
okay,
I apologize for that.
I have the percentages in front of me, if that helps.
But I'll tell you what's behind that is the fact that I've been hearing now for a year that we need a whole new definition of the role of the federal government. And so what I wanted to share with people was, you know, let's present to the American people best shots of both the New Deal Great Society and the so-called New Federalism of Nixon and then
Reagan.
Which essentially meant that the Great Society believed that federal government had the principal responsibility to step in times of huge national crises and to help those who ultimately, you know, could not help themselves, whereas the New Federalism's model instead was essentially that government was an enemy to progress, and that the government at best should be a facilitator for private resources and local resources. And I didn't see the numbers, but I know overwhelmingly they chose the Great Society model over the New Federalism model, I believe.
Interesting. And then there was also an agreement in large part, this was 71%, that it's now the time for a new definition of the federal government in our lives. 71% agree, 20% disagree.
Yep, and I that to me is momentous, because it tells me that I believe that Katrina will prove to be more of a defining moment in American history than 9/11, in the sense that it was shown that the system just simply broke down with Katrina, that the federal government wasn't prepared, that the leadership at the top didn't exist, and that when it came then to mobilizing resources and mobilizing parts of the administration to get the job done, it wasn't there. And it opened up a wide open sore with Americans saying, well, look, we don't want the federal government just simply to write checks and be the ATM machine. We need some leadership here, and it's probably time that we synthesize and create some sort of new role. Because, I mean, Americans also recognized that there were flaws in the New Deal Great Society model, and that it fit our system at a certain time, but we're at a point in our culture and our history where we need to do something different.
Now, I noticed that you said ultimately you think that Katrina is going to be seen as the defining event, although people said in the survey that at this moment in time, about 76% of them said they thought it was 9/11, 16% thought Katrina was the defining event. But really, September 11 could just as easily be characterized as a massive breakdown of the system. I mean, Bush had over 50 warnings that this thing was coming. We had the intelligence. We had an FBI agent living with two of the hijackers. There was just this terrible breakdown of the system. But that dimension of 9/11 is as virtually never discussed, even though that was the conclusion of the 9/11 Commission.
Well, I think that it's too uncomfortable for people to deal with. I mean, it's not unlike the same charge, never proven, but the same charge leveled about FDR on knowing in advance that Pearl Harbor was going to be hit. I mean, there seems to be considerable amount of historical evidence that FDR knew something was going to happen somewhere, and in fact, perhaps somewhere in the Pacific. And, of course, the communications weren't then what communications are today in terms of immediate communications and mobilization. But to draw then the conclusion that FDR
knew full well it was going to happen and didn't mobilize. Very uncomfortable for Americans, just like I believe that we're still feeling the wounds of 9/11, and that's just too uncomfortable a road for Americans to go down. Yes, today 9/11 still is raw and it hurts, and taken in conjunction with Katrina, they're both defining moments, 9/11 even more. I think still, though, that Katrina will have more legs on this down the road as a defining moment.
We have just 20, 30 seconds left. John Zogby, Zogby International, Zogby.com. George Bush's poll numbers.
34.5% job approval rating. His lowest for me was 31. Last month it was 36. What's interesting is that this poll that we have was taken entirely after the American public had a chance to digest the issue regarding the arrests in the United Kingdom. And so there was no terrorism bounce that the president received.
Interesting. John Zogby, thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Good to talk to you. We'll talk soon.
Great talking with you, John. John Zogby, the president and CEO, Zogby International, the website zogby.com. It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Yeah.
You were expecting me to say, or clean elections, right? No, we'll just leave it at that. We'll let them clip that little soundbite out and say, see, I told you so. Yes, I just got a bumper sticker in the mail. Dump the Republic crooks. It's great. Dump the Republic crooks. Great big, you know, great big letters. Dump the Republic crooks. Good one. I want to get into this whole issue of how the cons are dividing us. This whole divide and conquer strategy is a theme that I'm going to come back to in the next hour as well. And how it all works. And in fact, we're going to have a guest at the top of the hour who, in my mind, is also demonstrating that strategy. But first, we'll take a few phone calls here as we wrap up this hour. Carol in Whidbey Island, Washington. Hey, Carol, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to let your listeners know that I saw a wonderful movie. It's called Why We Fight. Mm-hmm. It is a documentary, and I'm sure that it must be available on DVD or video by now, because I saw this, interestingly enough, on Canadian television.
Oh, interesting.
This is a carefully constructed documentary on how we have come to be in the situation that we are now in this country, which is the very situation that Eisenhower warned us about before he left office,
right,
in his speech. Are you familiar with this movie, Tom, Why We Fight?
I am, Carol, I have not seen it. It was in limited theater release. It didn't, to the best of my knowledge, either it didn't come to Portland, or if it did, it was here like over a weekend that I was out of town. If it were playing, I'd see it, because I've had a number of callers over the last 6 months or so tell me about it. Apparently it's out and it's available in DVD as well.
It really is a must-see, because it really brings together all the various situations that we talk about, or that you've talked about in your program. It traces our wars from World War II to the present, and how they were manufactured, you know, I hate to say it, but how the information was manipulated to get the public support for whatever war that was, when there was really no threat at all. And this was done in the service of the armaments business. You know, we all understand that by now, but the movie is absolutely brilliant in how it brings this together, and And how it documents, you know, you can see it for yourself.
Yeah, you know, we see this with the armaments industry. We see it with pharma, for example. Billy Towson, the congressman who pushed through the Medicare bill that has the donut hole, you know, and that says the government cannot negotiate with pharmaceutical companies for prices. And then he goes and gets a $1 million a year job with pharma, the lobbying company. We should have laws in the United States. Number one, we should dramatically limit the ability of lobbyists to lobby. I mean, it's just wrong, the level of lobbying that's going on. And number two, we should pass a law that says that if you serve in government, you cannot then go into an industry that's regulated by government. Or maybe just the reciprocal, if you work in an industry that's regulated by government. No, it would have to be both ways. Then you can't go into government. Because and we, by the way, in the past have had such laws. And they're just not being followed. They're not being enforced right now. Carol, thank you very much for the call and the heads up. It's fascinating. Craig in Seattle. Hey, Craig, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I was just wondering what you knew about the, I believe it's Lazard-Serres banking system. I believe it's a European banking system.
I know and nothing about it.
Many of the members have been involved in both sides, the union side and the management side, in both the dismantling of the airline industry, the steel industry, and now they're in the process of being on both sides in auto industry. And like one of the guys who's a Democrat, Felix Rohatyn, is a member of Lazard-Serres. And I just, you know, because you have much better resources than I, would like to have you look into that and maybe discuss that, how there's been sort of a banking movement to tear down our infrastructure for like the last 30 or 40 years, along with all the political things that have been going on.
Interesting.
And they're also involved with the DLC.
Well, I'll keep my eyes open, Craig, and we'll see what we can come up with. I mean, every now and then you hear about these grand conspiracies and you track them back to you know, some fringe group or something. But on the other hand, sometimes, I mean, there really are grand conspiracies. Look at Iran-Contra. Larry in Seattle. Hey, Larry.
Yeah, Tom, a couple of quick items on the FEMA-financed trailers that are being used by the Katrina victims.
Mm-hmm.
Number one is the high levels of formaldehyde gas that's being detected by the Sierra Club. 30 out of the 32 trailers tested had...
Is that because of the new carpets and the glue?
And I believe also the urethane foam that they've been using for sealant.
Yeah.
Also,
this is a problem in new homes in general, you know, Larry.
Right. Well, these are sealed so tight, they're telling people they got to run their fans and keep the windows open. A lot of people are sleeping out in their cars because they can't stand the smell.
Oh my!
But the financing of the trailers goes into this no-bid contract routine that you talked about earlier about the cleanup of the area.
Mm-hmm.
The first contracts went out and they had one. Contractor come out with a $500 million bid, so they said, wait a minute, this isn't good, so we got to break that up into smaller contracts. But the smaller contracts all turned out to end up going to one major corporation, Fleur Corporation, out of Texas.
Surprise,
and they were also
surprise.
Together local companies in Mississippi and Louisiana.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this is their strategy, Larry. I mean, it's not even a strategy. I mean, this is their philosophy. Their philosophy, as Bill Clinton said in Seattle a couple of weeks ago, you know, their philosophy is that the quality, the value of a nation is defined by its wealthy institutions and wealthy individuals. And most Americans think that the value of a nation, the quality of life of a nation, is defined by its middle class. But they don't believe that, and so they concentrate wealth and power. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, Matt, back, my friend. 6 minutes past the hour here for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Number of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes has almost doubled in the last 30 years. Malaria has spread to higher altitudes in places like the Colombian Andes, over 7,000 feet above sea level. Flow of ice from glaciers in Greenland more than doubled in the last 10 years. At least 279 species of plants and animals already responding to global warming by moving closer to the poles. And in the face of this, Donald Boudreau, the chairman of the Department of Economics at George Mason University and an analyst with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, an organization funded in part by the oil companies and extremist right-wing foundations, suggests that the best way to deal with global warming is to neglect it. Donald Boudreau, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
We should neglect it?
Well, my point was, I think that's a bit, that I didn't say that in my article. What I said was
The headline of your article is The Case for Neglecting Global Warming.
Right, I didn't put the headline on the article. I don't know who did that.
I see. Okay.
My argument, and I defend it, my argument is that I don't have any doubt that science shows that global temperatures are rising. But that by itself, that fact alone, does not establish, as many people assume it does, a case for empowering government to take action against global warming. There is a scientific case, and I have a colleague who won a Nobel Prize for this, that government itself is fraught with all sorts of problems. And so it is a legitimate position, I'm not saying the right one, but it is a legitimate position that fear of misguided regulation, fear of excessive regulation, fear of regulation having itself lots of unintended consequences, the fear that those consequences are so likely that it's not an irrational, stupid, benighted position to say, look, I know global temperatures are warming, but some people might say my appropriate position is to, I don't want to empower government to take action against it. Let's just let it be as it is.
In your article, Donald Boudreau, you say the answer, and by the way, Competitive Enterprise Institute, Competitive is CEI.org if people want to check that out, although the article was in the Chicago Tribune.
Pittsburgh Tribune.
Pittsburgh Tribune, okay.
Yeah.
It must have been, okay, great. In any case, you say the answer, in a word, is capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Really, what you're referring to here is unrestrained laissez-faire capitalism as opposed to the kind of regulated capitalism that we see in the United States and other countries, is it not?
What I'm referring to is capitalism restrained by the forces of market competition rather than by bureaucracy and legislation.
Now, here's the fundamental problem with that. Capitalism seeking profits is always, number one, always trying to internalize profits and externalize costs. And when you externalize those costs into the commons, for example, the planet, the price is paid by all the rest of us, by we the people. And yes, there will be correctives in, the theory of laissez-faire capitalism that, if somebody makes a lousy product, eventually word's going to get around it's a lousy product, people won't buy it anymore, so corporations will have an incentive to come up with a better product. Makes sense. But when the harm is substantial, irreversible, life-threatening, shouldn't we, the people, collectively get together and say, hey, wait a minute?
And
that's called government.
And I'm much more suspicious of that kind of simplistic solution than you are. There is a huge literature that says that political action is itself fraught with all sorts of problems. It itself helps to externalize a lot of costs that otherwise are internalized.
Now, why would government try to externalize costs?
Government does externalize costs. For example, when I go into the voting booth and it's within government's power to say, decide how businesses in my region should be regulated. Well, I get to vote on how those businesses are regulated. I might not have any personal stake in it. And so that itself is a way of giving me, just as a voter, a say in how other people conduct their business. It may be the right thing to do, but it's still a way of giving someone who doesn't have a direct stake in the matter
a say in the matter.
No, it's we all have a stake in the matter. Sure, business is a game. Business is, you know, it's one of many games that we can conduct in our society, and it's a game that has rules. And we the people, establish the matrix on which business is played. We provide the stable currency through government providing a stable currency, Department of the Treasury. We provide a set of rules for the game to be played on through the legislation that we passed that, for example, protects intellectual properties, that says that, you know, protects contract rights, that we provide a system for adjudicating that. We have the referees and the decision-making process, courts through which people, if they feel that they've been done poorly as a consequence of the contracts that they've entered into, they can seek remedies for those torts. All of that is provided by we the people. So since we're providing the matrix on which the game of business is played, why shouldn't we set the rules? And why shouldn't those rules be in part, you can't hurt us?
The laws that you referred to basically are the result of a long period of evolution of Anglo-American common law rules. They are principally enforced in government courts, it's true.
Well, in a way, this was true in Samaria as well.
Outcomes, the vast majority of them.
This was true in Samaria 7,000 years ago as well. I mean, you know, what I'm describing is the necessary infrastructure in order to conduct business, and that infrastructure has to be created by we the people. There's no such thing.
No.
Governments
no,
create markets.
No, they don't. Governments emerge unplanned from individual actions.
Well, you could argue that markets do too.
There's a huge difference between imagining a central bureaucracy sort of planning everything, as opposed to having a system of courts in which people bring disputes to those courts, and then allowing the disputes themselves to give rise to a system of law over time.
But the nature of the decision in those disputes is not an abstraction. It's not something that's just going to emerge from the court case. What you're going to have is one party coming to the court saying the law that was passed by government, by we the people, that says that this part of this contract should be enforced has been violated by that guy over there, and therefore please enforce the law.
Yeah, but first of all, that's not how contract law emerged. Contract law existed long before people legislated it. Now, there is legislation, I grant you, but the laws you're referring to, I mean, which, and we agree that the list you gave a moment ago, I agree with all that. But those laws were not the original result of people getting together in a legislature and saying, hey, let's have contract law, let's have it look like this, and let's have tort law, and let's have it look like this, and let's have property law, and let's have it look like this.
I would argue that they did, and it was originally informal and called culture.
That's just factually wrong. They didn't. I mean,
You had in primitive societies where you had barter, as the means of exchange. There was still a social structure that defined what was appropriate barter.
But that's different than having government do it. I mean,
no, that is government.
No, it's not.
Government is us. This is a democracy here in the United States. It's a democratic republic, a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic. Government is us.
Well, I disagree. I mean, government is an institution that gets certain powers.
But not rights. We the people hold the rights. The first three words of the Constitution of the United States, we the people. We're the only ones with rights.
I agree completely, but that doesn't mean that everything we do is the government, and that everything the government does is us.
I never suggested that, but the point that I'm making is that the government in the United States is we the people, and if we the people are concerned about our welfare, and we are concerned that corporate behavior in this capitalist world, that corporate behavior may be harming us or harming future generations or even putting the planet at risk, I don't understand why you are opposed to we collectively getting together and saying to for example, the oil industry or the automobile industry, for example, you know, it's fine that you're going to make cars and we think that's a great thing and you're making a profit and employing people and all that. Wonderful, wonderful. But by the way, you have certain mileage standards that you're going to have to hit. These are the rules of the game.
And why can't those standards, though, be set by individuals when they just choose to buy cars? If I want to buy a car that gets only 7 miles to a gallon, why is that any of someone else's business?
Because your exhaust may be killing my planet.
Ah, okay. But then you can have rules that limit exhaust. We can agree there.
But your 7 miles per gallon is exhausting carbon dioxide.
You specify. See, this is part of the problem. When you have central solutions, they tend to command and control. They tend to specify outcomes. And
and just because they may be the result of the democratic process, I don't think that they're necessarily correct. Democratic process has produced lots of absurd, ridiculous results.
Of course, and so has capitalism. But not as many. But the bottom line here is when you're talking about serious harms, why not be, I mean, the destruction of the planet, the things that could destroy civilization, things that lead to the destruction of New Orleans, for example, why not say, we the people, we're gonna say, go a little slow on this. We're gonna be cautious rather than reckless.
I agree completely, and so I would be very cautious before
But corporations creating... are not. They're just trying to be a profit.
But they're trying to get profit largely within a very thick and nuanced system of legal rules. Yes, there are corporate bad actors, just as there are government bad actors. But just the pursuit of profit by itself is not bad. And just
I'm not suggesting it is, but I'm saying that in some arenas, the pursuit of profit may and in fact has, I would submit to you, Donald Boudreau, has overshadowed the pursuit of the public good or the need of the public good, the need of the public survival, frankly.
And my only claim, just to get back to the original, I'll tell you why I wrote the article. It irritates me that people assume that opposition to empowering government to do more against global warming is necessarily a sign of stupidity or ignorance or scientific illiteracy. There is a large body of political science and economic literature that suggests that government itself is subject to many dysfunctionalities, that it can...
No, I agree with you on that, and I understand that. But let's just boil this right down. The industries in the United States that are producing the majority of the greenhouse gases are the oil industry, the coal industry, and the automobile industry. Why would any of those industries find that global warming and the havoc that it can wreak in things like, you know, more Hurricane Katrina's and more malaria coming into North America and diseases moving north and species becoming extinct, none of which could be ever considered a cost to the auto industry or to the oil industry? Why would the oil industry or the auto industry ever change their ways given those kinds of things happening?
I didn't say that they would, and I didn't say...
Then how can capitalism address global warming that it's creating?
I didn't say that it would. What
said in your article, the solution to all this is capitalism, and I'm asking you, okay, here's the capitalist system. How are these capitalists going to solve this problem? They're not.
Capitalism does solve lots of problems. It has unquestionably made our lives cleaner.
But how is it going to solve global warming?
Please listen to me. My point is that if there is no government action against global warming, it may continue. It may continue. There are other benefits that capitalism brings that may help us deal with it at a more localized level.
Isn't that like saying, gee, you've got cancer, but keep brushing your teeth?
No, it's saying that if you've got cancer and the guy comes over here and he's offering to knock it out with a pickaxe, then you might want to try to deal with it some other way.
Donald Boudreau, he's the chairman of the Department of Economics at George Mason University and an analyst of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the author of an article titled The Case for Neglecting Global Warming, and in the Pittsburgh Tribune, you said, sir?
Pittsburgh Tribune Review, yeah.
And Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Donald Boudreau, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Interesting conversation.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
To confirm Ben Bernanke is the 14th chairman of the Federal Reserve.
Every breath you take, every change of rate, jobs we don't create, while we still stagnate, I'll be watching you. Every single day, Bernanke takes my pay. When growth goes away, inflation will stay, and I'll be watching you.
a few more bits. When demand then dips and the yield curve flips, I'll be watching you.
Oh, yeah, we'll be watching you, Ben Bernanke. And, you know, I have to say, in a way, poor Ben. You know, I mean, Alan Greenspan set this thing up. He's been a toady for Republican politicians for 25 years. He was initiated into Ayn Rand's cult of objectivism back in the 1950s in her apartment in New York City and never left it. If you want to read all about it, there's a marvelous book Robbie Batra wrote called Greenspan's Fraud. It just outs the whole thing. And poor Ben Bernanke, I mean, he just walked into the thing. He has inherited an absolute disaster. Mud Mike over in our chat room says, global warming offers all kinds of opportunities for profit. Yeah, unrestrained laissez-faire capitalism, marvelous stuff. Building dikes, fixing destroyed cities like New Orleans. Yeah, global warming, more opportunities for capitalists. Yeah, yeah, well, you know, tell that to the folks in New Orleans. I'm not sure that they're going to be all that enthusiastic about it. And you know, is another one coming? Well, certainly they will. Certainly they will. So I want to get back to this thing about divide and conquer, and we can continue our conversation about laissez-faire capitalism. We can take your calls as well. 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466, right after this break here at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
All my bags are packed, I have my ID, a printed itinerary, a boarding pass, and major credit card. And I'll show you that my computer works. I'll shake my head at all the jerks whose crankiness is making this so hard. Me to check for clues. Tell me to take off my shoes. Touch me, ask me what you need to know. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Just stand in line and don't complain.
And soon they'll let me go.
Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Oh, yes, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we run rings around the right wing 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back to our program. Every day, noon to 3 Eastern Time, 9 to noon Pacific Time, weekdays, syndicated by Air America Radio. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. By the way, my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, is now in bookstores and on Amazon. You can find it, you can go to tomhartman.com and you can find a link to various booksellers. And also, there is one chapter of it that I recorded as an audio chapter, and you can find that on the website of AM620 KPOJ. The website is 620kpoj.com. You just go to 620kpoj.com. They have on that website the just look for the sneak peek of Tom Hartman's new book, you know, or Screwed. You can keyword Screwed, and you'll find it, and you get to hear me reading a chapter of my own book. And, you know, it's free. Download the thing. You can listen to it. You can stream it live, whatever you'd like. 1-866-440-THOM, Richard in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Richard.
I'm surprised you're not more in favor of a laissez-faire economy, Tom, since a laissez-faire economy cannot abide or afford an imperial foreign policy. And I think a good percentage of your listeners will probably agree with me that with the coming end of our empire, that'll mean more freedom for everyone in the world.
I would submit to you, Richard, that laissez-faire economics in large part is what has led to an imperial foreign policy, because laissez-faire economics in other words, absolutely unrestrained capitalism, allows capital to aggregate in such large quantities and producing institutions of such great power that you have, for example, the vice president of Lockheed Martin, who founded the Committee for a Free Iraq, which put forward Ahmed Chalabi and the whole front group that led us into this war. I mean, he was one of the founders of the whole Project for New American Century. This is coming out of defense contractors. I would submit to you that if the defense industry was as constrained and restrained as Republican President Dwight Eisenhower suggested it should be, we would not be in the war in Iraq right now.
Well, the fact is, something happened in 1896 where we lived under a laissez-faire economy for 60 years or so, and what took over from laissez-faire was a corporation capitalism economy. And I think your issue is more with corporation capitalism than it is with laissez-faire.
Are you talking about 1886, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad?
No, 1896.
Okay. What happened in 1896?
A depression happened. And
the Great Panic of, I thought that was 1897, but okay.
And McKinley tried to install policies to correct the depression, but he couldn't. And what presidents usually do when their policies can't affect the economy is start a war and distract the people's attention. But
right.
I really think
he did a marvelous job of with the Spanish-American War. But some would suggest, actually, you go back and you look at the history of Mark Hanna, that Mark Hanna suggested that McKinley should start that war so he could get himself reelected. And a lot of people have been examining this now since Karl Rove, when Bush first came into office. Karl Rove said that he was patterning his job, his role model was Mark Hanna. And Mark Hanna was the guy who's advised McKinley to start the Spanish-American War, to claim that the Spanish had blown up the USS Maine in Havana Harbor when, in fact, the boiler blew up, and create a war so he could get himself reelected. And he did, and he did.
And that goes with all American presidents who start wars. They're just seeking for popularity, that's all. And the American people...
I would agree with the exception of Franklin Roosevelt. I think that war came to us.
Well, you know that Franklin Delano Roosevelt put an embargo on Japan.
I know, and he realized that there would be some blowback, but I think that war came to us in as much as Hitler was taking over Europe, Tojo was taking over Asia, and we really had to join with our allies. And the Republicans in Congress were so absolutely adamant that we should just let Hitler do whatever he wanted to do. And you know, whether Roosevelt set up Pearl Harbor or not, and I have some pretty good evidence that he did not, but that's not, you know, he certainly set up the conditions for it by embargoing the oil through the Straits of Malacca. It seems to me, you know, were I him in those circumstances, I would have done the same thing.
Well, thanks for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Richard. Good talking with you. Matt in Sacramento. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today?
Oh, referring to your book on ancient sunlight.
Yeah, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight.
I was thinking, if you put back all the carbon that was in all the coal from the Carboniferous times and all the oil,
right,
if you put all this back into the atmosphere, you're going to recreate the atmosphere they grew in.
That's right.
And if you do, I have a feeling you're going to have something that's a lot nicer to plants than it is to us.
Well, that's how it was then, and this is the atmosphere of 300 to 400 million years ago is
correct.
The atmosphere that produced the carbon that is under the ground that we're pulling out. And at that time, the most complex plants were ferns, and some of them were 100 feet high. I mean, these are just massive things. This was before trees in their modern form had evolved, and the largest animals were insects, you know, and giant cockroaches.
So the ability to live in that environment, we better quit worrying about flooding Florida and start worrying about the atmosphere we're breathing.
Yeah, it brings us back to
that it will create.
Yeah, it brings us back to the old story about after a nuclear war, the only survivors will be cockroaches because they can survive, you know.
No, this is
radiation.
My point. I mean it really because
yeah. No, I
watch my deer pant up here in 100 degree weather. What do they do when it's 115? The plants will make it, but will they?
Yeah. Exactly. And in fact, right now what's happening is a lot of the plants aren't making it because you have particularly trees that have a lifespan, you know, longer than the climate cycle changes is. And so as the drought moves north and as the heat moves north, you have trees that were adapted to a climate that's now, you know, 300 miles north of them. It's no longer where they are. And so when I lived in Vermont, we were having, and when I lived in Germany for that matter, same thing, huge swashes of coniferous forest where the trees really needed a little bit colder climate. And they can't just get up and move like some of the animals could.
Right. And anyway, so my real point is, I think by burning this fuel, it really comes down to we're closing the climate window we live in on a planet that keeps evolving.
That's right.
It's very frightening.
It is. It's something that we
should
be concerned
about. Anyway, God bless, and let's hope for the best.
There you go.
And work for it.
And work for it, indeed. Matt,
Bye.
You got the message. Thanks a lot. KJ and Camus. Hey, KJ.
Hi, Tom. You know, you've said in the past that a corporation is really nothing more than a legal fiction. The label is to do business, and intellectually, I know you're right, but that's... I guess what I want to ask is, do you see any kind of blowback or backlash against the whole concept of corporation maybe coming up the road, assuming that we can turn things around?
Well, we're entering a period that is, back to McKinley, we're entering a period that's not that different from the late 1800s. You know, we're coming back into Victorian era economics. And the blowback against corporations, I mean, they were called robber barons, and people who worked were referred to as producers, and people who owned factories were referred to as capitalists. And the language was very different at that time, in large part because most newspapers were small businesses, and newspapers were the primary media of the country. And these small businesses were owned by people who did not view their interests as being congruent with those of the robber barons. And so the robber barons got beat up pretty badly in the press. And therefore, the American people knew what was going on. Nowadays, most of our media is owned by the very corporations that are doing a lot of the damage. So our best hope for a backlash is that the media would lead it. And I'm very concerned, frankly, that the media is not willing or capable of doing that. And frankly, I'm very concerned about that. Although, you know, the ray of light in all this is what you're listening to right now. And I don't mean me specifically, but the fact that there is programming, progressive programming, and it's taking hold across America, and it's actually making a profit. It's actually, you know, being successful. I mean, we have advertisers on this program, and God bless them and please support them. People get it that something's wrong, and they want to hear this message. So I think that what we need to be doing is amplifying this message as much as possible, telling people about the radio program, telling people about websites that carry this message, because you're not gonna get it from MSNBC, for it, tragically, or NBC or CBS or ABC.
Well, rock on.
Yeah, you too, KJ. I mean, we just have to spread the word. Frank in Hallowell, Maine. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I can tell you about laissez-faire capitalism in New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm from the French Quarter. I'm now living in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
My apartment in the French Quarter wasn't damaged by the flood, but it was the roof blew off and the walls are infested with black mold.
Mm.
My landlord had the building was condemned, and the landlord simply paid a fee to somebody to get it uncondemned and doubled the rents, and is renting it out now to people who are getting sick from the black mold.
Holy cow.
That's the way it works there.
Yeah, well, welcome to raw capitalism. Frank, thank you very much for sharing that story with us. Much appreciated. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, News Without Conflicts of Global Corporate Interest. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's embarrassing each time I hear detectors beep on my brassiere. It's underwire, so watch your hands, you punk. There's no hurry now, my flight's delayed. It's all because somebody made a joke and dad, so it's our father drunk. So frisk me to check for clues. Tell me to take off my shoes. Touch me, ask me what you need to know. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Just
get to go. Now it's time, unless they're lying, one more line, and I'll be flying a random search, and I'll be on my way.
Yes. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Thanks so much, by the way, to my producer David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Andrew Dunn, Lauren Kirchner at Air America Radio in New York, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on this website, on our website at TomHartman.com, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thank you so much. You make it possible, and it's truly appreciated. 51 minutes past the hour, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. We're going to be coming back to your calls in just a moment. But first, let's check out what's happening with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
In Ramadi, these are the following of security and other developments in Iraq as reported on as of Friday, 16:30 GMT from Reuters. Dateline Ramadi, U.S. tanks shelled a mosque in that Sunni stronghold after coming under attack from gunmen inside the building. A doctor in Ramadi hospital said three people were killed and 22 wounded by U.S. fire. In Balad Ruz, three teenage boys were killed and three wounded when a makeshift bomb exploded on a field where they were playing football. In Nasiriyah, three people were killed and two wounded when gunmen clashed with guards at a Sunni mosque there. In Bakuba, nine people died in separate attacks in various parts of the city. In Rashad, a roadside bomb targeting an Iraqi army patrol exploded in that small town. In Hawija, six people, including three policemen, were wounded in a hand grenade attack in the market. And in Qaim, the body of an Iraqi soldier with multiple gunshot wounds and bearing signs of torture was found in an area near the Syrian border. Meanwhile, George W. Bush sticks with a fight them there theme, as echoed by Congressman Kurt Weldon, Republican from Pennsylvania, who said, and I quote, "We either fight them here or we fight them in the supermarkets and streets here." Yes, if we're not fighting them in Iraq, if we were not fighting the Iraqis in Iraq, they would all hop on a plane and come through security and show up in our supermarkets complete with their AK-47s. Meanwhile, the number of U.S. troops in Iraq has climbed back up to 138,000, driven up in part, this is from the Associated Press, by the need to control the escalating violence in Baghdad and the decision to delay the departure of an Alaska-based Army brigade. Sharon in Sacramento, California on the line. Hey, Sharon, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Your book just showed up in my mailbox this morning, Screwed.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
So
well, I hope you like it.
Oh, great. I'm sure I will, because I have friends who've been trying to educate me on this stuff, and now I'll have to educate them on who you are.
Okay.
A lot of the farmers in Northern California have been saying these types of things that you've been saying in your book. Also, last night I went to Bob Watada's meeting here in Sacramento, and there was the Peace and Freedom Party, and they had an article called Why Socialism by Albert Einstein.
Yes. This was in defense of Lieutenant Aaron Watada?
The meeting was in defense.
Yeah, that's great. And the article, Why Socialism by Einstein, I read that years ago. I don't frankly remember what it said now. I mean, it's been probably 30 years since I read it.
Well, hopefully maybe you can help me with some of the sentences, but I chose a few sentences just as response to who your guest was today talking about capitalism. And no one disrespects Albert Einstein that I know of. So I circled a few sentences
okay,
here.
We're almost out of time, Sharon. We may have to carry some of this over into next week, but take a shot at the first one here.
I am convinced there is only one way to eliminate these grave evils, namely through the establishment of a socialist economy accompanied by an educational system which would be oriented towards social goals. An exaggerated competitive attitude is inculcated to the student who is trained to worship acquisitive success as a preparation for his future career.
Yeah. Now, what's the unfortunate problem here is that what Einstein is describing as socialism in that article is what the Swedes would describe as socialism, but what we here in the United States would describe as regulated capitalism. And, you know, it's because socialism, the definition of socialism by and large here in the United States is Marx's definition, which is the state owns the means of manufacturing and distribution. And that's not what Einstein was advocating. He was advocating tight regulation of corporate behavior, basically.
Yeah, he says it leads to a huge waste of labor and the crippling of social consciousness.
And he was advocating strong labor policies, strong environmental policies, you know, basically strong regulation of corporations, and a strong social safety net, you know, a basic, you know, there's a web underneath it all.
So, okay, thank you,
Sharon. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the book.
Good. Yeah, enjoy it. Yeah, let me know what you think. It's out now in bookstores. Coast to coast, screwed the undeclared war against the middle class and what we can do about it. Coming up Monday, Wesley Smith, the conservative, arguing against the right to die. Erwin Redliner is going to be here with his book, Americans at Risk, Mega Disasters, that and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.